The Brendan O'Connor Show on RTE Radio 1 with All Care Pharmacy. Advice and expertise on the relief you need from hay fever at All Care Community Pharmacies across Ireland.
In the week that Imagine turned 50, 91 minutes of mostly unheard interview tapes with John Lennon have come up for sale. And they're kind of good, the tapes. There's a lot of little fascinating little insights into Lennon. So DJ and broadcaster Kate Brennan-Harding joins me now. Kate,
hi.
Good afternoon.
So, how are you?
So Kate, tell us first the background to this. What was going on in John Lennon's life and career at the point he did these interviews?
Well, this is the thing. So the interviews, they were recorded over three sort of sessions from 1969 to 1970. So that's a really small window of time. But we have to remember that the Beatles did everything. Like, they condensed probably 50 years of work into like 9 years.
Yeah.
They were unbelievable. I mean, Beatlemania was a kind of mania, all right. So he had retreated into Tittenhurst Mansion, which was his property in Ascot, and he'd married Yoko Ono. The Beatles were beginning to, like, they were completely disintegrating. They weren't really talking to each other. They were still releasing it. Let It Be, and they were still putting things together. Phil Spector was putting stuff together for them, but they weren't really hanging out, and Brian Epstein had died a couple of years earlier, so they'd sort of gone through this massive transformation. Lennon in particular had gone through a massive transformation between going to India, all of them seeing the Maharishi, and then obviously falling in love with Yoko Ono, who seems to have been a catalyst in helping him to extricate himself from Beatlemania.
Yeah, and also, would you say, kind of, you know, to use the modern terminology, Yoko Ono kind of woke him, or was instrumental in him waking up in a different way, wasn't she?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, like, the thing is, Yoko Ono, sometimes a lot of people want to give out about her breaking up the Beatles, but the Beatles were on that road anyway. And the thing is that, like, John, I'd say, was probably looking for someone to attach himself, because imagine...
This is like Harry and Meghan,
like,
isn't it?
Yeah, well, I suppose some people have drawn similarities to that as well. But
so
I mean,
she was
like,
his escape route.
Maybe his escape route, but also maybe his chance to take responsibility for his life in a way that he'd been... I mean, I know he you know, he experiments with various kind of methods and various ideologies, but, like, at least he found a love that actually meant that he wanted to transform who he was. He wanted to take on, because he was quite toxic, and he wanted to take on that, kind of take on responsibility for who he was in the world and to make change in the world, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So he talks about Yoko in these interviews, does he?
Yeah, he talks. I mean, they'd only just married. They'd been together a good while at that stage. They were inseparable. I mean, some might, like, if you start reading up on their relationship, it's quite fascinating, but it's also like, you know, they don't go to the toilet without each other in times. Do you know what I mean? But he speaks in these interviews just very caringly and gently, because he's completely in love with her, and he's completely in love with his new way of life and his newfound freedom, so to speak.
Yeah, because you get this sense as well that at this point he was kind of, as you say, Beatlemania had all been very fast and very crazy. He's now stepping back and processing being a Beatle and talking about the fame and what it did to him as well.
Yeah, he's a really interesting kind of take on the fame, in that he kind of describes it. He says it that they were possessed by a spirit of people adoring us, and having all that energy that people gave to us, we lose the way. So that's, you know, taken from obviously these tapes. And his own take on fame is just like, you know, I don't really want to be possessed by it. And so he had to work on himself an awful lot. He also kind of goes on as well. There's another really, I thought that was really interesting. He talks about how he doesn't see the Beatles as actually being the catalyst for creating such change in the 60s. He's like, we were, you know, on top of the wave, but we were not the wave. And I suppose from my experience, and I, you know, I wasn't born when Lennon and the Beatles were all in the mainstream, but I have been fascinated with the Beatles since I was a kid. And every single thing around the 60s is pinned on the Beatles for me, in terms of any kind of documentaries or any kind of books I've read, and the culture and everything. So, and they were immersed in it. So I kind of think from the legacy, I think that they were the catalyst for change. And I think John Lennon in particular, he's a real agitator. I've used that word earlier in the week. He's an agitator. He was never happy or content, and you know, he hated injustice, even though he obviously was agitating it himself, because he was causing he was violent at times, and he was wrestling with the world, I think, you know.
Yeah, yeah, because I think there was a sense when he met her, wasn't there, that he was kind of, in many ways, a toxic northern male, and that had that part of him, like, but that he was trying to kind of transcend, wasn't it?
Well, I think it's that he realised, you know, I would imagine that he just realised, oh, okay, this behaviour really can't continue. And he took on, like, he's incredibly misogynistic. He was violent towards his previous partners. He owned that later, much later than these recordings, he owned that. And, you know, I think that there's a great, like, there's no cancel culture, even though the Beatles obviously were threatened with cancel culture when John Lennon compared them to Jesus. But his actions, he was continuously honest about being a flawed human and wanting to take on that and to be something else in the world.
Yeah, yeah. No, yeah, but like, look, that's a nice way of looking at it. And yeah, other people would say that he was a nasty piece of work all his life, but there you go.
I'm not there to judge. I like his music.
Absolutely.
I find his actions absolutely apparent at times, you know?
Yeah, yeah. So listen, back to the music. The other thing that I think people have been slightly fascinated by is that he picks his favourite Beatles songs. So tell us about his favourite Beatles songs.
Well, the thing that is also interesting is that, like, obviously, Paul and him weren't really talking at the time, so he picks his own songs, and I mean, he laughs in the tapes. He's like, "Yeah, I'm prejudiced. I like my own," but he picks some quite, you know, the thread between all the songs that he picks are quite unique. They go from like 1967 up to 1969. Revolution Number 9. Are you familiar with that track?
Yeah, one of those psychedelic-y ones on the White Album, isn't it?
It's more than psychedelic. It's he imagined it that it would be the sound of revolution. So it is quite it's quite uncomfortable to listen to at times. It's unnerving to listen to. Harrison and Yoko Ono feature in it. It's got a lot of backwards recording, stereo panning left to right. It's a very strange song that a lot of people were like, "What on earth is going on here?" So he names that. He's like, he loves that one. And then he goes from that. He goes into Strawberry Fields Forever. Which he says that he absolutely loved as well. And in fairness, that's probably because he grew up playing in Strawberry Fields and, you know, has since been immortalised. But again, all experimenting with psychedelia. He stated before, he had said before that he always liked and reckoned Strawberry Fields Forever was one of his great songs. So I suppose he's just reinstating it again, you know. Mm-hmm. And then Rain, a song that not a lot of Beatles fans really, or people outside of Beatles fans would know too much. It's basically the B-side. I miss B-sides, by the way. I wish there was more B-sides. It is. It was a B-side, and it again features backwards recording. So the key feature on Rain is John Lennon. He's got backwards vocals. He said that he discovered that by an accident. He went home from recording, and he used to always listen back to himself. And let's just say he was under the influence, and he turned the tape the wrong way around and was fascinated for quite a while listening to himself backwards. And that's where the idea apparently came for.
Okay.
For him,
so there
to
is a thread
backwards
here in that. I know Strawberry Fields Forever is kind of a classic Beatles in a way.
Yeah.
But the thread here is like he's kind of kicking back against the old Love Me Do and all that, and it's more him as an experimental artist. And the other one he picks is A Day in the Life, which again is an amazing song, but it's quite experimental too, isn't it?
Well, it is. I mean, A Day in the Life, I think personally is one of my favorite Beatles tracks,
so,
because it's beautiful, but it's also like you really do see. It's harmony, and I'm not talking about the melody. I'm talking about McCartney, producer Martin, you're talking Lennon, all of them working together on an idea to create something that was really cohesive. To me, like, it's also like, I love as well that the start of it is, you know, references, or is supposed to have referenced the death of socialite Tara Brown, you know, the Irish heir. And it's so gorgeous because you've got Lennon who's being sort of, you know, watching the world, and then you've McCartney who's talking about, you know, I woke up, got myself out of bed. Do you know what I mean? So you've got the two mindsets, so
there,
to speak.
There it
know?
Is. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, listen, they were lovely little nuggets. Thanks a million, Kate, Brennan, Harding.
No problem, Brendan.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a break.